University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June Examination Session, 2007. English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your center number, candidate number, and name on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you're doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. Now you are all ready. Here is the test. Look at the questions for part 1. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Natap plays the trumpet and is to tour with his college orchestra. Why must he arrive at the departure point early?
So, we'll be away for 10 nights and we'll play 6 concerts, as well as having full-day rehearsals, so it will be quite tiring for all of you on tour. The coach leaves from the college car park at 6 a.m, but don't forget, you need to be here 30 minutes before that in order to load your instruments safely into the separate trailer. So, we'll be away for 10 nights and we'll play 6 concerts, as well as having full-day rehearsals, so it will be quite tiring for all of you on tour. The coach leaves from the college car park at 6 a.m, but don't forget, you need to be here 30 minutes before that in order to load your instruments safely into the separate trailer.
Question 2. You are travelling to King's Bridge and are in a hurry. Where and when will you find the best train for your journey?
Passenger announcement. The stopping train service to King's Bridge will depart from Platform 9B in 5 minutes' time. Passengers wishing to travel direct to this destination should wait for the express service, which will be arriving on Platform 9A in 12 minutes' time. Passenger announcement. The stopping train service to King's Bridge will depart from Platform 9B in 5 minutes' time. Passengers wishing to travel direct to this destination should wait for the express service, which will be arriving on Platform 9A in 12 minutes' time.
Question 3. Samir is using the washing machine at the laundrette. Which 2 further steps must he take to make the machine work?
Excuse me. Could you help me, please? This machine has a flashing red light when it should be washing my clothes.
Let's see. First, choose your type of wash. You want general wash. And then press the green button. That gives you the red light. The next step is to insert the correct change, £1.50. And finally, press start. If the machine displays a yellow light, press reject and start again. Simple.
Oh dear, I'll try again. Excuse me, could you help me, please? This machine has a flashing red light when it should be washing my clothes.
Let's see. First, choose your type of wash. You want general wash. And then press the green button. That gives you the red light. The next step is to insert the correct change, £1.50. And finally, press start. If the machine displays a yellow light, press reject and start again. Simple.
Oh dear. I'll try again.
Question 4. Why should you surf in 2 days' time? Give 2 details.
Shall we go surfing at the beach tomorrow after school finishes?
The weather forecast says only to expect a light breeze. I think it'll be too calm. We'll just have to swim instead.
Well, let's try and go surfing on the day after that. It's the weekend anyway, so we can stay all day. And there's sure to be some wind by then and some enormous waves for us to ride on. Shall we go surfing at the beach tomorrow after school finishes?
The weather forecast says only to expect a light breeze. I think it'll be too calm. We'll just have to swim instead.
Well, let's try and go surfing on the day after that. It's the weekend anyway, so we can stay all day. And there's sure to be some wind by then and some enormous waves for us to ride on.
Question 5. What action does the doctor recommend to help Sanjit's throat? Give 2 details.
Your throat looks very sore, Sanjit. I think you need to rest your voice. No shouting or singing. And go to the chemist and get this medicine at once. Your throat looks very sore, Sanjit. I think you need to rest your voice. No shouting or singing. And go to the chemist and get this medicine at once.
Question 6. Why must Asim's surprise celebration take place in the afternoon?
Let's have a surprise picnic for Asim's birthday tomorrow. I'll bake a cake.
I'll bring crisps and cola and tell the others not to say anything to him about it.
Good. We'll find Asim at lunchtime and go and sit by the river. No, there's a cricket club practice. We'll have to go after school at 4 o'clock instead. Let's have a surprise picnic for Asim's birthday tomorrow. I'll bake a cake.
I'll bring crisps and cola and tell the others not to say anything to him about it.
Good. We'll find Asim at lunchtime and go and sit by the river. No, there's a cricket club practice. We'll have to go after school at 4 o'clock instead.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at the questions for part two, exercise one. Part two. Part 2, Exercise 1, Question 7. Listen to the following interview about chocolate and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening and welcome to Food Weekly. Tonight's programme features some new healthy recipes and suggests ways of reducing salt and sugar in our diet. The surprise is that many of these ideas use chocolate as an ingredient. Chris Chang, the leader of the Campaign for Real Chocolate, is in the studio to talk to us. Chris, chocolate is good for our health. True or false?
True, of course. But it does depend on which type of chocolate you buy and use in your cooking.
We'll come back to those details. But first, tell us about your role as leader of the Campaign for Real Chocolate.
I have loved chocolate ever since I was a young child. I grew up in a large family and loved traditional family celebration times, where we might be given gifts of chocolate bars or sweets or chocolate eggs. I'm a dietitian now, and I realised that the chocolate we buy all too often is made from sugar, fat and milk, and is sold as a family chocolate bar. Of course, it just tastes sweet. Nothing like real chocolate should taste.
So you've taken action to promote good chocolate?
Yes. In 2001, I founded the campaign to speak out against chocolate manufacturers who argued that adding fats and sugar in the production of chocolate was acceptable and, of course, cheaper. Actually, chocolate should only be made with cocoa and cocoa butter.
Oh, so how will we know which is the good chocolate when we buy a bar?
Read the back of the packet. Good dark chocolate will contain only 30% sugar, while the lowest quality chocolate contains as much as 80%. Poor quality chocolate will also only have about 5% cocoa on its list of ingredients, whereas the best will have between 50% and 70%.
Why is it important for the makers of chocolate to use cocoa butter in their chocolate and not vegetable fat?
Because cocoa butter is a unique fat. It's what we call a saturated fat, but it behaves like an unsaturated fat, which means it's good for you. It has been shown to reduce blood cholesterol levels.
So good chocolate really is good for our health?
Of course, but only if the chocolate is good quality and made with the correct ingredients. Remember, real chocolate has high percentages of cocoa butter and cocoa, not sugar and vegetable fat. If made correctly, the chocolate also contains a multitude of vitamins and minerals and has antidepressant effects.
You mean it makes us feel happy?
It can certainly make you feel more positive. It also helps to stimulate the brain.
Can you tell the quality of a piece of chocolate by tasting it?
Oh, yes. And so can you. Try these simple steps. The chocolate will smell good. It might remind you of fruit or wood. When you break the chocolate, it should appear reddish in colour. This shows us how much cocoa is in the bar. The redder it looks, the higher the quantity of cocoa used.
Good. Any more tips?
Yes. The chocolate should make a distinct snapping sound when you break it, and it should melt easily. Cocoa butter itself melts at 34 degrees Celsius. Finally, of course, it should taste smooth and delicious.
Lovely. Chris Chang, thank you very much for your advice. We'll all know how to search for and recognise real chocolate now.
Good. Remember that real chocolate is good for you, and enjoy eating it.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening, and welcome to Food Weekly. Tonight's programme features some new healthy recipes and suggests ways of reducing salt and sugar in our diet. The surprise is that many of these ideas use chocolate as an ingredient. Chris Chang, the leader of the Campaign for Real Chocolate, is in the studio to talk to us. Chris, chocolate is good for our health. True or false?
True, of course. But it does depend on which type of chocolate you buy and use in your cooking.
We'll come back to those details. But first, tell us about your role as leader of the Campaign for Real Chocolate.
I have loved chocolate ever since I was a young child. I grew up in a large family and loved traditional family celebration times, where we might be given gifts of chocolate bars or sweets or chocolate eggs. I'm a dietitian now, and I realised that the chocolate we buy all too often is made from sugar, fat and milk, and is sold as a family chocolate bar. Of course, it just tastes sweet. Nothing like real chocolate should taste.
So you've taken action to promote good chocolate?
Yes. In 2001, I founded the campaign to speak out against chocolate manufacturers who argued that adding fats and sugar in the production of chocolate was acceptable and, of course, cheaper. Actually, chocolate should only be made with cocoa and cocoa butter.
Oh, so how will we know which is the good chocolate when we buy a bar?
Read the back of the packet. Good dark chocolate will contain only 30% sugar, while the lowest quality chocolate contains as much as 80%. Poor quality chocolate will also only have about 5% cocoa on its list of ingredients, whereas the best will have between 50% and 70%.
Why is it important for the makers of chocolate to use cocoa butter in their chocolate and not vegetable fat?
Because cocoa butter is a unique fat. It's what we call a saturated fat, but it behaves like an unsaturated fat, which means it's good for you. It has been shown to reduce blood cholesterol levels.
So good chocolate really is good for our health?
Of course, but only if the chocolate is good quality and made with the correct ingredients. Remember, real chocolate has high percentages of cocoa butter and cocoa, not sugar and vegetable fat. If made correctly, the chocolate also contains a multitude of vitamins and minerals and has antidepressant effects.
You mean it makes us feel happy?
It can certainly make you feel more positive. It also helps to stimulate the brain.
Can you tell the quality of a piece of chocolate by tasting it?
Oh, yes. And so can you. Try these simple steps. The chocolate will smell good. It might remind you of fruit or wood. When you break the chocolate, it should appear reddish in colour. This shows us how much cocoa is in the bar. The redder it looks, the higher the quantity of cocoa used.
Good. Any more tips?
Yes. The chocolate should make a distinct snapping sound when you break it, and it should melt easily. Cocoa butter itself melts at 34 degrees Celsius. Finally, of course, it should taste smooth and delicious.
Lovely. Chris Chang, thank you very much for your advice. We'll all know how to search for and recognise real chocolate now.
Good. Remember that real chocolate is good for you, and enjoy eating it.
That is the end of Part 2, Exercise 1. In a moment you will hear Part 2, Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 2, Exercise 2. Question 8. Listen to the following interview about tanzanite, a mineral found in Africa, and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello, and welcome to our series on Rocks of the World.
Even in ancient times, writers stated that there was always something new to be found in Africa. Here is geologist Bertolt Bach to tell us about the latest find from a mine near Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania.
Hello. Yes, the world's biggest lump of Tanzanite, so-called because of the country of its origin, Tanzania, has been found 270 metres below ground.
I've never heard of Tanzanite.
It's the newest precious stone, and people love its appearance because of its deep blue colour. It's perfect for use in jewellery, for example. Blue gemstones are, after all, rare.
Does it have the same status as a diamond, then, do you think?
Tanzanite is considered fifth in importance after diamond, emerald, ruby and sapphire.
So, is it really new?
Fairly. It was discovered in 1967 by Maasai tribesmen, and its only source is an area of about 13 square kilometres in the mountains in the north of Tanzania. Tanzanite is actually rarer than diamond, so you can imagine the excitement of the Tanzanian miners who uncovered this huge piece of Tanzanite.
Mm. How large is it exactly?
It's the size of a building brick and weighs more than 3 kilograms, enough for 30,000 rings or pieces of jewellery.
It must have a huge value.
About $15 million.
So why is Tanzanite blue? Is it something to do with the minerals in the soil in the area of the mine?
In its natural state, this precious stone is grey or brown, but it turns blue when heated to 300 degrees Celsius. Originally, the Maasai tribesmen discovered examples scattered over the ground. The rocks had been turned blue by the heat of bushfires, which had been started by lightning. Miners often bring out this blue colour themselves by baking the mineral after first wrapping it in dough.
In dough? Bread dough, do you mean?
Yes, it protects the tanzanite.
Ah. So what will happen to the latest huge tanzanite rock?
It's to be displayed in various museums and eventually will be cut up to be sold. Look out for the Mawenzi Tanzanite exhibition in your own country. The mining firm which found the rock has named it Mawenzi after the second highest peak in Tanzania.
Oh, why didn't they name it after the highest mountain in the country?
Because one day a lucky miner might dig up an even larger piece of tanzanite.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, and welcome to our series on Rocks of the World. Even in ancient times, writers stated that there was always something new to be found in Africa. Here is geologist Bertolt Bach to tell us about the latest find from a mine near Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania.
Hello, yes. The world's biggest lump of tanzanite, so-called because of the country of its origin, Tanzania, has been found 270 metres below ground.
I've never heard of tanzanite.
It's the newest precious stone, and people love its appearance because of its deep blue colour. It's perfect for use in jewellery, for example. Blue gemstones are, after all, rare.
Does it have the same status as a diamond, then, do you think?
Tanzanite is considered fifth in importance after diamond, emerald, ruby and sapphire.
So, is it really new?
Fairly. It was discovered in 1967 by Maasai tribesmen, and its only source is an area of about 13 square kilometres in the mountains in the north of Tanzania. Tanzanite is actually rarer than diamond, so you can imagine the excitement of the Tanzanian miners who uncovered this huge piece of tanzanite.
Mm. How large is it exactly?
It's the size of a building brick and weighs more than 3 kilograms, enough for 30,000 rings or pieces of jewellery.
It must have a huge value.
About $15 million.
So why is tanzanite blue? Is it something to do with the minerals in the soil, in the area of the mine?
In its natural state, this precious stone is grey or brown, but it turns blue when heated to 300 degrees Celsius. Originally, the Maasai tribesmen discovered examples scattered over the ground. The rocks had been turned blue by the heat of bushfires, which had been started by lightning. Miners often bring out this blue colour themselves by baking the mineral after first wrapping it in dough.
In dough? Bread dough, do you mean?
Yes, it protects the tanzanite.
Ah. So what will happen to the latest huge tanzanite rock?
It's to be displayed in various museums and eventually will be cut up to be sold. Look out for the Mawenzi Tanzanite exhibition in your own country. The mining firm which found the rock has named it Mawenzi after the second highest peak in Tanzania.
Oh, why didn't they name it after the highest mountain in the country?
Because one day a lucky miner might dig up an even larger piece of tanzanite.
Now turn to part two. You will hear a man called Chris Graham talking to a group of students about a vacation job he had in Australia. For questions 9 to 18, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds to look at part two.
Hello everyone, my name is Chris Graham and I spent my last vacation working in Australia. The place I was in is a popular tourist spot, so there are lots of student jobs advertised in the newspaper, from hotel work to being a tour guide. I saw my job for a bus driver on the internet and so I applied. I'd recommend you do that too. The whole idea of getting to know another country really appealed to me, and I'm really pleased I had the opportunity to go. I worked for a company which tries to help tourists understand what life used to be like before Europeans arrived, a time before clothes, cars, and electricity. Many of the local people, the Aborigines, work for the company. Studying tourism at university wasn't essential to get the job. In fact, my subject's history. What I did do was a short training course when I first arrived, though, to learn about the local plants and animals. At first, I was given a room in a hotel in town, but I found that I felt quite lonely, so I moved into a caravan on the outskirts. Lots of other staff lived on the site, and I got to meet lots of the local people there too. Everyone was really friendly, and as there wasn't a cinema or restaurant nearby, people frequently had a party on Saturday night, and I was always invited. I worked 6 days a week, and I had to get up really early in the morning when most people, and even the birds and animals, are asleep. This is so the tourists can get to take photos of the sunrise. I used to pick them up from their hotels around 5 a.m. and then head out of town and into the desert. The tourists were from all over the world and often had no experience of the heat. They knew, of course, about covering their head and neck with a hat, but often left their shoulders uncovered, which wasn't very sensible, especially if they hadn't been in the country for long and weren't used to the sun. After we had been into the desert, I would take the tourists to the local cultural centre, where they had the opportunity to ask questions. The tourists were especially keen to find out how to distinguish the tracks of kangaroos from wallabies and wild dogs. After the morning session, I usually went back home, had a shower and a rest, then started again around 2 in the afternoon. I used to take the afternoon group to a waterhole where they were shown which plants could be eaten and which were also used to make weapons for hunting. At one time, there were very few tourists in the particular area I worked in because you needed to get a coach from the small railway station in the nearest large town, a good 200 kilometres away. There's now an airport, but the local government is keen to get one built which can take more flights, especially from abroad. I'm not sure about that, as I think it's busy enough as it is, but it would be good for the local economy, no doubt about it. Anyway, I really recommend working in Australia during your vacation. The busy tourist season in the area where I worked is from May to October, so you need to make sure your application is in by the January of the year you're hoping to work. You might not hear until March, as it takes a while to process the applications and get references, but make sure you don't leave it too late.
Now you will hear part two again.
Hello everyone, my name is Chris Graham and I spent my last vacation working in Australia. The place I was in is a popular tourist spot, so there are lots of student jobs advertised in the newspaper, from hotel work to being a tour guide. I saw my job for a bus driver on the internet, and so I applied. I'd recommend you do that too. The whole idea of getting to know another country really appealed to me, and I'm really pleased I had the opportunity to go. I worked for a company which tries to help tourists understand what life used to be like before Europeans arrived, a time before clothes, cars, and electricity. Many of the local people, the Aborigines, work for the company. Studying tourism at university wasn't essential to get the job. In fact, my subject's history. What I did do was a short training course when I first arrived, though, to learn about the local plants and animals. At first, I was given a room in a hotel in town, but I found that I felt quite lonely, so I moved into a caravan on the outskirts. Lots of other staff lived on the site, and I got to meet lots of the local people there too. Everyone was really friendly, and as there wasn't a cinema or restaurant nearby, people frequently had a party on Saturday night, and I was always invited. I worked 6 days a week, and I had to get up really early in the morning when most people, and even the birds and animals, are asleep. This is so the tourists can get to take photos of the sunrise. I used to pick them up from their hotels around 5 a.m. and then head out of town and into the desert. The tourists were from all over the world and often had no experience of the heat. They knew, of course, about covering their head and neck with a hat, but often left their shoulders uncovered, which wasn't very sensible, especially if they hadn't been in the country for long and weren't used to the sun. After we had been into the desert, I would take the tourists to the local cultural centre, where they had the opportunity to ask questions. The tourists were especially keen to find out how to distinguish the tracks of kangaroos from wallabies and wild dogs. After the morning session, I usually went back home, had a shower and a rest, then started again around 2 in the afternoon. I used to take the afternoon group to a waterhole where they were shown which plants could be eaten and which were also used to make weapons for hunting. At one time, there were very few tourists in the particular area I worked in because you needed to get a coach from the small railway station in the nearest large town, a good 200 kilometres away. There's now an airport, but the local government is keen to get one built which can take more flights, especially from abroad. I'm not sure about that, as I think it's busy enough as it is, but it would be good for the local economy, no doubt about it. Anyway, I really recommend working in Australia during your vacation. The busy tourist season in the area where I worked is from May to October, so you need to make sure your application is in by the January of the year you're hoping to work. You might not hear until March, as it takes a while to process the applications and get references, but make sure you don't leave it too late.
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear five short extracts in which people are talking about happiness. For questions 19 to 23, choose from the list A to H what each person says happiness means to them. Use the letters only once. There are three extra letters which you do not need to use. You now have 30 seconds to look at part three. Speaker 1.
What is happiness? From an early age, happiness for me is sitting in a boat in the middle of a lake on a summer's day and doing some serious fishing. All alone, just me and my thoughts. No stress, get away from it all for an hour or so. But maybe not completely aimless, not just lying on a beach somewhere, but having some task to do. Then, when it's all over, it's back to normal life and problems and hassle and having to fight to get what you want. But that brief moment of happiness helps me to reflect and make sense of my life.
Speaker 2.
I think to be happy, you do obviously need some financial security. Not rich, I didn't say that, because there's an important difference. Also, I'd say you need humour in your life. That's kind of obvious too. Having lots of free time to do what you want. Not sure there. I'd say quite the reverse, actually. For me, you really appreciate your moments of leisure when you've done lots of hard work. If it's all play and no work in your life, then you don't enjoy it. So for me, it's all to do with setting yourself a list of things to get through. And then you've completed them, now you can be happy.
Speaker 3.
I sometimes wonder if being happy is something to do with age. Very young children are happy most of the time. Very old people are happy when they think of fond memories, and also they're happy when they see their grandchildren happy. So happiness is not just specific to one age group. That's certainly the case with my family. But in my experience, happy people get through life more easily. If you take things seriously all the time, that's when you get stressed or have health issues, maybe. And sometimes life can be a real pain, let's be honest.
Speaker 4.
Happiness comes in many shapes and forms. Personally, I'm happy when I'm active, doing my sports, and feeling all healthy. But maybe that's a rather self-centered view. I also get moments when I'm just, say, sitting on a train and suddenly I think of my children's smiling faces and realize how lucky I am, how happy they make me, and my husband too, of course. My life could have turned out much worse, as it has for many people. Will I still be happy when they've all grown up and gone away? I'm sure when that time comes, I'll find a new form of happiness.
Speaker 5.
It's sometimes said that you make your own happiness, and I've got some sympathy for that view, but in my experience, it's something more than that. It might sound strange, but I honestly think it's all about your life not being too easy. If everything in your life is handed to you on a plate by rich parents, then I actually don't think you're as happy as someone who's had to struggle a bit in their life. When you can share your struggles with others and laugh about how you got through them, that's when you're truly happy. That's certainly how it's worked out for me.
Now you will hear part three again. Speaker 1.
What is happiness? From an early age, happiness for me is sitting in a boat in the middle of a lake on a summer's day and doing some serious fishing. All alone, just me and my thoughts. No stress, get away from it all for an hour or so. But maybe not completely aimless, not just lying on a beach somewhere, but having some task to do. Then, when it's all over, it's back to normal life and problems and hassle and having to fight to get what you want. But that brief moment of happiness helps me to reflect and make sense of my life.
Speaker 2.
I think to be happy, you do obviously need some financial security. Not rich, I didn't say that, because there's an important difference. Also, I'd say you need humour in your life. That's kind of obvious too. Having lots of free time to do what you want. Not sure there. I'd say quite the reverse, actually. For me, you really appreciate your moments of leisure when you've done lots of hard work. If it's all play and no work in your life, then you don't enjoy it. So for me, it's all to do with setting yourself a list of things to get through, and then you've completed them, now you can be happy.
Speaker 3.
I sometimes wonder if being happy is something to do with age. Very young children are happy most of the time. Very old people are happy when they think of fond memories, and also they're happy when they see their grandchildren happy. So happiness is not just specific to one age group. That's certainly the case with my family. But in my experience, happy people get through life more easily. If you take things seriously all the time, that's when you get stressed or have health issues, maybe. And sometimes life can be a real pain, let's be honest.
Speaker 4.
Happiness comes in many shapes and forms. Personally, I'm happy when I'm active, doing my sports, and feeling all healthy. But maybe that's a rather self-centered view. I also get moments when I'm just, say, sitting on a train, and suddenly I think of my children's smiling faces and realize how lucky I am, how happy they make me. And my husband, too, of course. My life could have turned out much worse, as it has for many people. Will I still be happy when they've all grown up and gone away? I'm sure when that time comes, I'll find a new form of happiness.
Speaker 5.
It's sometimes said that you make your own happiness, and I've got some sympathy for that view, but in my experience, it's something more than that. It might sound strange, but I honestly think it's all about your life not being too easy. If everything in your life is handed to you on a plate by rich parents, then I actually don't think you're as happy as someone who's had to struggle a bit in their life. When you can share your struggles with others and laugh about how you got through them, that's when you're truly happy. That's certainly how it's worked out for me.
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. You will hear part of a radio interview with an author called Mickey Smith, who is talking about becoming excellent at sport. For questions 24 to 30, choose the best answer, A, B, or C. You now have 1 minute to look at part 4.
Today on the programme we have Mickey Smith, author of the book The Power of Practice. Mickey, in your book you talk about what makes a champion sportsperson. Your argument is that talent, a natural aptitude or skill, doesn't exist, right?
Right. I know that's controversial because it's thought that people are born with natural abilities. I have my critics, but the evidence from research I've done backs up my argument. If you look at anyone who's reached a high level in any complex task, you'll find they've spent many years building up to it. This has started other people thinking and doing their own research. I've no doubt they'll reach the same conclusions I have.
What about physical abilities like speed? Isn't that what makes one footballer better than another, for example?
There are physical issues that are significant in some activities. However, in virtually all complex tasks, the limiting factor is a mental thing. People don't become the greatest footballers because they move around the pitch quickly. While he may not realise it, the way a great footballer understands where his teammates are around him on the field is what helps him score goals, rather than speed.
In your book, you also talk about geographical areas where lots of people become experts in the same activity. Gymnastics, for example.
The town I grew up in produced the top gymnasts of my generation, myself included. My initial reaction when I got to the top was, wow, I must have been born with this ability to do gymnastics. But what about the others? What I now understand is that this excellence was down to having access to a fantastic coach and a seven-day-a-week gymnastics club where we transformed ourselves from ordinary to extraordinary. Opportunity's another factor determining success.
Your argument is that to become excellent, you have to practice for thousands of hours. That's a lot of training.
That's right. How successful you are is down to how long you're prepared to work. Evidence suggests those who make it believe excellence relies on practice. If you believe being good at something is down to natural ability, when you fail, you'll think you don't have enough of it and you're more likely to give up. If you believe excellence is about effort, when you fail, you're going to see it as an opportunity to grow.
What approach should coaches take when training youngsters in sport?
The way to go about it is to ensure the child enjoys what they're learning, that it becomes an internal desire to progress. Coaching young people is more about psychology than it is about the technical side of things. It's making the young performer really care about where they're going, motivating them in the right way that will enable them to actually get there. Little difference from how you encourage adults, really.
Why don't more people who play sport try harder to improve?
Well, they see sports stars and assume they were born brilliant, but there's no evidence to suggest that. You just don't see the painstaking process it took to get them there when they're winning games on your TV screen. If you did, their brilliance wouldn't seem so miraculous. The illusion is to think they got there quickly and think, oh my goodness, I could never get up that slope.
Given everything you've said about top performers, why do they sometimes fail at crucial moments? That's called choking, right?
Yes, it's to do with the expectation to succeed, no matter how many times they've done it before. When you first practice a skill, you have to exert conscious control over it. When you become proficient, you're able to do it subconsciously. When you choke, you become so anxious that instead of delivering your skill automatically, you become conscious of what you're doing and it's like you've never done it before.
Thank you very much.
Now you will hear part four again.
Today on the programme we have Mickey Smith, author of the book The Power of Practice. Mickey, in your book you talk about what makes a champion sportsperson. Your argument is that talent, a natural aptitude or skill, doesn't exist, right?
Right. I know that's controversial because it's thought that people are born with natural abilities. I have my critics, but the evidence from research I've done backs up my argument. If you look at anyone who's reached a high level in any complex task, you'll find they've spent many years building up to it. This has started other people thinking and doing their own research. I've no doubt they'll reach the same conclusions I have.
What about physical abilities like speed? Isn't that what makes one footballer better than another, for example?
There are physical issues that are significant in some activities. However, in virtually all complex tasks, the limiting factor is a mental thing. People don't become the greatest footballers because they move around the pitch quickly. While he may not realise it, the way a great footballer understands where his teammates are around him on the field is what helps him score goals, rather than speed.
In your book, you also talk about geographical areas where lots of people become experts in the same activity. Gymnastics, for example.
The town I grew up in produced the top gymnasts of my generation, myself included. My initial reaction when I got to the top was, wow, I must have been born with this ability to do gymnastics. But what about the others? What I now understand is that this excellence was down to having access to a fantastic coach and a seven-day-a-week gymnastics club where we transformed ourselves from ordinary to extraordinary. Opportunity's another factor determining success.
Your argument is that to become excellent, you have to practice for thousands of hours. That's a lot of training.
That's right. How successful you are is down to how long you're prepared to work. Evidence suggests those who make it believe excellence relies on practice. If you believe being good at something is down to natural ability, when you fail, you'll think you don't have enough of it and you're more likely to give up. If you believe excellence is about effort, when you fail, you're going to see it as an opportunity to grow.
What approach should coaches take when training youngsters in sport?
The way to go about it is to ensure the child enjoys what they're learning, that it becomes an internal desire to progress. Coaching young people is more about psychology than it is about the technical side of things. It's making the young performer really care about where they're going, motivating them in the right way that will enable them to actually get there. Little difference from how you encourage adults, really.
Why don't more people who play sport try harder to improve?
Well, they see sports stars and assume they were born brilliant, but there's no evidence to suggest that. You just don't see the painstaking process it took to get them there when they're winning games on your TV screen. If you did, their brilliance wouldn't seem so miraculous. The illusion is to think they got there quickly and think, oh my goodness, I could never get up that slope.
Given everything you've said about top performers, why do they sometimes fail at crucial moments? That's called choking, right?
Yes, it's to do with the expectation to succeed, no matter how many times they've done it before. When you first practice a skill, you have to exert conscious control over it. When you become proficient, you're able to do it subconsciously. When you choke, you become so anxious that instead of delivering your skill automatically, you become conscious of what you're doing, and it's like you've never done it before.
Thank you very much.
That is the end of part four. There will now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I shall remind you when there is 1 minute left so that you are sure to finish in time. You have one more minute left. That is the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.